Hi there. Before we begin, let me explain something. This 12-part series was made at WYSO, a small public radio station in Southwest Ohio. We had financial support from Ohio Humanities, but we relied on WYSO's staff and infrastructure to get the job done. We'd be grateful if you could make a contribution at wyso.org. Thanks.
Hey there, thanks for listening. I'm Chris Welter. Throughout this podcast, we've talked a lot about federally recognized tribes and their history and spoken with their enrolled citizens.
We've talked about how the state of Ohio, universities here, and other organizations are intentionally partnering with the tribes to improve their programming and to work on collaborative projects. But we haven't explained what it means to be an enrolled citizen, why it's significant, or how federal recognition has become connected to tribal sovereignty.
We'll do that in this episode, so stay with us. You're listening to The Ohio Country. This is episode 11, called Pretendians. When we talk about federally recognized tribes, we're referring to modern American Indian nations with a particular legal status with the United States federal government. This recognition means they have a government-to-government relationship with the United States and other modern nations. An enrolled citizen of a tribe meets the membership requirements for that tribe and is registered, meaning they may be eligible for certain benefits or to run for political office. When European people and their governments came to the Ohio River Valley, they signed treaties under international law with nations like the Shawnee, Miami, Lenape, also known as the Delaware, Seneca, and Wyandot. Those treaties established those nations' rights to land, resources, and self-governance. The U.S. government, therefore, recognized those nations as sovereign, or in other words, as having the authority to govern themselves. Nations like the Shawnee, Miami, and Wyandot create and enforce their laws, manage land and resources how they choose, and operate healthcare and education programs for their citizens. Citizens of those nations elect their leaders. All recognized tribes today have legally proven to the U.S. government that they have historical continuity as distinct communities with governing structures. As we've said before, there are no federally recognized tribes headquartered in Ohio, and no reservation lands within its borders. When the U.S. government forcibly relocated tribes from Ohio in the 19th century, they ended up in modern-day Oklahoma, Minnesota, Canada, and Michigan. But the citizens of federally recognized tribes live and work in diaspora, in their Ohio River Valley homelands, across the U.S. and beyond.
What is citizenship anyway, and what is ancestry? The question of who can be enrolled as a citizen is up to each federally recognized tribe to define for themselves, not DNA tests, heritage websites, or family legend. You can't just decide for yourself that you're an enrolled citizen. There's a legal process to go through. Many individuals and groups have claimed to be part of so-called remnant bands of Shawnee, Seneca, Cherokee, or Delaware. But there is no historical evidence that these so-called remnant bands ever existed. And the federally recognized tribes of those communities don't see them as legitimate. Even so, some of these groups and individuals have profited off their claims to American Indian tribal identity. And they've spread a lot of disinformation. People and institutions in Ohio haven't always questioned this legitimacy, but that seems to be changing.
Let's go to Serpent Mound in southern Ohio. It's an incredible place, nestled in the Appalachian foothills. It's one of the largest effigy mounds in the world. The mound itself is in the shape of a snake. It's over 1,000 feet long, and its tail forms a spiral. There's some debate about when the mound was built. The best available archaeological data suggests it was constructed between 500 and 1,000 years ago by the ancestors of modern-day Shawnee people and other closely related groups like the Miamia and Kickapoo. If you remember from episode 5, archaeologists call that period in what we now call southern Ohio the Fort Ancient Era. Nowadays, people come from around the world to see the Serpent Mound, especially on the summer solstice.
At some point in the past 50 years, the mound became a destination for New Age spiritual seekers who believe it holds a special energy. and crowds came again on the summer solstice in 2023. The mood was reverent and respectful at the mound.
It was like they couldn't figure out how to put it into the mental framework. It's like, that doesn't belong. It must be just
the Ohio History Connection, Ohio's state history nonprofit, has actively managed Serpent Mound since 2021. When Chris was there in 2023, visitors saw new informational signs written in collaboration with the federally recognized tribes. The History Connection had also invited a few of its staff archaeologists and leaders from the Shawnee and Miami tribes to talk to the public about the mound, what it means to their communities, and how its symbols connect to their modern-day religion. Groups of visitors listened to presentations from the experts and asked good questions. Many said it was the first time they ever met a Miamia or Shawnee person.
A few hundred yards away at a property called the Soaring Eagle Retreat, it was a very different scene. As you walk in, a sign reads, "No tribal or Indian policing." That means you aren't supposed to ask people who are representing themselves as Native Americans if they are citizens of federally recognized tribes. Delcy Wilson, whose family owns the retreat, is the executive director of the Friends of the Serpent Mound. Her husband, Jeffrey Wilson, is president of Friends of the Serpent Mound and is an amateur archaeologist who has been on the well-known pseudoscience Netflix show Ancient Apocalypse to talk about the mound. He's self-published multiple books promoting his theories about Serpent Mound. The festival has around 50 vendors selling everything from dream catchers to fried food to sacred crystals. One vendor has set up a Western Plains-style teepee tent. Delcy Wilson says they put up the No Tribal Policing sign because lots of their attendees identify as indigenous or have so-called indigenous spiritual beliefs, but aren't citizens of federally recognized tribes.
And we have a lot of individuals that are either indigenous individuals or they believe as an indigenous would with the belief of connecting with Mother Nature and Mother Earth. And so a lot of individuals like that go to Serpent Mound, and it's their temple, it's their sacred ground, you know. It's, we just want to let people know that we include everyone. And so it's not just because you're not of one culture or another that you can't appreciate Serpent Mound. That's, you know, we include everyone.
Wilson says they used to hold their festival on site at the Serpent Mound, but the Ohio History Connection asked them to move a few years ago. She and her organization believe that indigenous people built the mound, but she and many of the presenters aren't convinced that it was the ancestors of modern-day tribes, like the Shawnee and Miami, who built it.
There is giant skeletons that were found at Serpent Mound. And the facts are there. There's images of them on postcards. The artifacts are still at Peabody Museum. And they were over 8 feet tall. You can't ignore what the facts are. Now, are those giants indigenous? Are they something else? We'll never know until the DNA is actually tested on those skeletons. But that being said, we still feel that it was the indigenous cultures that, and there was a whole race of large, you know, indigenous peoples too. So it could have been one of that culture. So. But anyways, we allow people, we give them a platform to share their stories, and then the public goes away with what they wanted.
To clarify, what Wilson just said is false. There was no ancient race of giants who built the Serpent Mound. Fringe theories like these are popular at the Summer Solstice Festival. There are booths with people who call themselves Bigfoot experts and presenters who believe aliens or maybe fallen angels had something to do with the Serpent Mound's construction. Theories that aliens, giants, and Bigfoots built the Serpent Mound are racist and insulting to American Indian people today, whose ancestors built it. That's part of why, when the Ohio History Connection resumed fully managing the property, they asked the Friends of the Serpent Mound to take their festival and false theories elsewhere. Wilson isn't happy that her organization can no longer hold its festival on park grounds. She argues that tribal governments like the three Shawnee tribes, all based in Oklahoma today, shouldn't be able to determine what people do in Ohio.
You know, we include everybody. And, you know, I'm going to go there. I probably shouldn't. But, you know, we're the ones, you and I, we're Ohioans, right? It's our tax monies that are going into that state park.
The Ohio History Connection has also dug up dozens of crystals buried in the mound. There were also multiple reports of people having sex and dancing naked on top of the mound when the Friends of the Serpent Mound held their festival there, including one instance where Chief Glenna Wallace of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma and Chief Barnes of the Shawnee Tribe witnessed and heard the lewd behavior. Delcie Wilson of Friends of the Serpent Mound says the festival has always been family-friendly and denies that people from her festival ever had an orgy on the mound. However, she admits that some attendees danced naked on the mound late at night when Chief Barnes and Wallace attended the festival. She says she would have stopped the dancers, but she left the festival to put her kids to bed, and when she returned, the chiefs had left.
But it's, you know, it's, I think sometimes, a lot of times either half-truths or incomplete stories, you know, is the problem.
Another contentious issue has been drumming. The Ohio History Connection has asked people from the Summer Solstice Festival not to play drums on or next to the mounds, because the federally recognized tribes they work with aren't sure that's how their ancestral communities who used the Serpent Mound for their ceremonies would have wanted the religious site to be used. So, people from the festival do their drumming at the Soaring Eagle Retreat next door, within earshot of the mound. And hundreds of people come to watch every year. It's pretty easy to tell that the drummers and their ceremonies aren't authentic to the Eastern Woodland tribes, like the Shawnee in Miami, whose ancestors built Serpent Mound. The drums at Soaring Eagle are big powwow drums, not water drums, which is the type of drum most Eastern Woodland tribes use. It would also be unusual for a modern-day tribe with roots in southern Ohio to have a ceremony open to the public like this, since they reserve religious traditions for their citizens. On the day I was at the festival, a performer named Terry Rivera introduced a drummer and singer named Ben Sayer. Before he started, Rivera addressed Sayer's identity, challenging the idea that he isn't, quote, native enough, end quote.
So I'd like to start with our sun dancers. And he is a sun dancer at the Salt Creek. Salt Creek, Teoshfe. And we sometimes hear from people that, well, he's not native enough to do these ceremonies. To those people who were saying, why are you here? You're not native enough. Have you ever sun danced? Have you ever looked at that sun? Have you ever danced for the people? Have you ever done the work? And pretty soon they would quiet down. Because it's heart. It's heart. And it's the creator. It's the space. So we're going to start with a song.
We are back, yeah.
And a note here, a sun dance is a religious ceremony practiced by tribes from the Great Plains and Canada, and it's unclear what language Sayer is singing in. Terry Rivera also performs under the name Sings with Ravens and also goes by a Dakota language name that she says means good talk woman. She lives nearby and owns a rock and crystal shop called Alternate Universe. She believes the area around the Serpent Mound has a special energy, perhaps caused by a meteor that fell to Earth in this area hundreds of millions of years ago, and she has profited from it. Rivera organizes what she calls Serpent Mound Star Knowledge Summits, charging $40 to $90 a person. The summit offers presentations from what she calls wisdom keepers, elders, and ceremonialists, along with music, dancers, and ceremony. Rivera says online that she is Native American, but doesn't specify which tribe. She also says her mission is to, quote, help others rediscover, as she has, their own indigenous spiritual identities, end quote. She performs songs like this one, which combines the Buddhist and Hindu concept of energy centers called chakras with what she says are songs inspired by the energy at Serpent Mound.
Some of these songs that I sing are ones that have came to me, that have come to me at this very Serpent Mound place. This one was a time where it told me how to line yourself up with the Serpent Mound. And there's some things about the Serpent Mound. Some people say, I'm going to go there and I'm going to activate that serpent. Truth be told, you go there in a humble way and pray, it just might activate you. So we pray there and we listen to the trees and watch the ants and, you know, give thanks for the flora and the fauna and the people that walk that path. So one night, through special permission, and it's been a long time ago, this song came to me. And we're going to start with your first energy center. Some of you might be aware of chakras. It's kind of the same way. But this energy is going to serpentine your chakras. For balance. First chakra. Hey na 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 hey na hey na ho hey na. Second chakra.
Stereotypical and inaccurate representations of American Indian people, like the ones that Chris saw at Serpent Mound, are not hard to find at festivals and gatherings around the Ohio River Valley, and they're often performed by people who claim either vague or unverified indigenous ancestries. Some academics and indigenous leaders call these people pretendians.
Chief Ben Barnes of the Shawnee tribe says events with pretendians can quickly devolve into what he considers to be American Indian minstrel shows, a comparison to the racist form of American theater that stereotyped black people as dim-witted, lazy, and happy-go-lucky, and were performed by white actors in blackface in the 19th and 20th centuries. Chief Barnes spent part of his childhood in Ohio, near Dayton and Huber Heights. He remembers fishing in the Great Miami River, and he became a lifelong Cincinnati Reds fan. Barnes moved to Oklahoma and eventually was elected as a politician in his tribe. He refers to the Shawnee homelands now as Back East. He's also on the board of directors of the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. Barnes has been an outspoken advocate for how his constituents and their history are presented in the Shawnee homelands. And he's been doing this work for more than 10 years. At times, it's been dangerous. In 2021, the first year the Friends of the Serpent Mound were asked to hold their festival next door, he had to wear a bulletproof vest to the presentation he was invited to give at Serpent Mound by the Ohio History Connection. He received death threats for his positions on tribal citizenship and what activities should be allowed near the mounds. Barnes is also a scholar. He co-edited a book with Stephen Warren, who we heard from in Episode 5. The book highlights how American Indian people today are recontextualizing the historical record and telling their own stories by collaborating with historians, archaeologists, and universities. In 2022, he spoke at a conference called Unsettling Genealogies, Unmasking Pseudo-Indians at Michigan State University, where American Indian scholars, artists, and activists from across the country gathered over Zoom to discuss issues related to false tribal identity. A recording has been posted to YouTube.
We're a tribe with this history in 20-some eastern states, a tribe of removal, and a tribe of that left a vacuum behind, and in that vacuum is a legacy of invisibility, and people step into that vacuum and represent us. Before I get started, I guess I want to introduce myself appropriately. Hato Keto Yokopi Ben Barnes no ki mitesito wokimasasa wano kid wapakamisa tamini lepa nihuchpia My name is Ben Barnes. I'm chief of the Shawnee Tribe. And more importantly, and perhaps how I got started on this path, is I'm also a member of a religious community, a traditional religious community of Shawnee people, but we still have our ancient traditional practice. It goes back more than 1,000 years. You can find traces of our religious practice in the archaeological record in Kentucky and Ohio and elsewhere.
The archaeological record he mentions, which contains traces of modern-day Shawnee religious practice, can be seen at places like Serpent Mound. And because those sites are significant for Shawnee religious practice, Barnes cares deeply about how people today care for and behave at them.
From that framework, not as a politician, not as an elected official, but a member of that traditional community, that I first encountered fake Indians. And I'd heard about them from elders of our tribe and who had told us the stories about these folks back east wearing crazy clothes and pretending to be us. And they would throw these powwows. And our tradition is not a powwow. We're Eastern woodland people. We use a water drum. We don't use a big drum. So, you know, there was these ridiculous stories. But then as I got older and started to become a language class volunteer, we needed to start collecting material from elders. And some of the things that elders were telling us is, you can't let this information get out. I was like, well, that's crazy. I mean, if I was teaching Chinese language, if I was teaching Spanish, I could talk about the culture of Spain or the culture of China, but somehow we can't talk about that. So then I came encountered with it for the first time. Saw it for the first time where folks were appropriating identity of Shawnee people, stealing our language and representing our culture, misrepresenting our culture, and performing minstrel shows. I mean, honest to goodness, minstrel shows. And the public back east in Kentucky and elsewhere just devoured it. And as recently as just a few years ago, you could participate in a 5K outside of Lexington. You could pay money, and you have wild Indians chase you on your 5K run. These people dressing up this way. Everybody thought that this was appropriate. When I became an officer, a council person at the tribe, we started traveling back east and on behalf of the tribe in official capacity. And we get invited to meetings. Representative Boehner, he was the House of Representatives, Speaker of the House at the time, invited us to an event commemorating the bicentennial of the Second Treaty of Greenville. And there was the damnedest looking group of people there dressed up in dead animal skins I ever saw. And they were running around at this event, and it was a 2-day event. And it was the first time I'd actually ever seen it with my own eyes. And looking at these people that was watching these people, that's how they thought Indian people were. They thought we acted like that all the time. And these people were have this affected this manner of speech to make them sound like either they was half caveman and half from the res.
Barnes says he quickly learned that those people back east claiming a tribal identity weren't just wearing offensive and inaccurate costumes or painting their faces red and covering themselves in dirt while affecting a racist manner of speech. Some people claimed and appropriated specific tribal identities, like Shawnee.
We have to talk about this as an existential threat to identity because it affects so much of our lives as Indian people. They're an existential threat to tribal nations. They speak as if they are tribal nations themselves, particularly in states where the removal happened, where there are no tribal nations anymore because people were either through migration of coercion, collusion, or forced, or removal, the left a vacuum. For me, this is a human rights issue where they're pretending to be my people. They are pretending to be us. They're taking away from my culture and my people. They're stealing our intellectual property, but they're actually stealing orthographies. Stealing the way that languages are written. They're stealing language class materials now. What amounts to 4% of our tribal population is enrolled in language class as either teacher or student. But that transparency and that availability of language class material has allowed those people to steal our lessons, steal our language. Now they're able to take that back east and use it to add to their repertoire in their minstrel shows. So this is cultural appropriation at its most egregious. This is not some runway designer stealing patterns. They are actually stealing our very identity.
Barnes also says that institutions in the Ohio River Valley have legitimized these individuals and groups and haven't always taken the time to question them and their claims to American Indian identity and representation.
And we have federal agencies helping them. When the Cumberland National Forest allowed one of these groups to perform one of their minstrel shows, the Shawnee tribe, the Absentee Shawnee tribe of Oklahoma, the Eastern Shawnee tribe of Oklahoma, all formally protested. And the regional director told the Shawnees, "I'm sorry, we've already printed the flyers. This is not just a U.S. issue. Obviously, for those that are in the know, that's also an issue in Canada, but it's not just an issue in North America. Anywhere there's indigenous people, there's people pretending to be them, whether they're Sami, Karelian, Aboriginal, because in some place, those peoples have status. They have some sort of special status that is inherent to the land, that is claimed under international law as having special relationships. These, in fact, are not even racial identities. These are identities that are rooted in international law that pre-exists the United States. And this is also not a race issue. I want to point that out. While I'm saying it's not a race issue, it is most certainly rooted in racist and white supremacist thought. And I think we cannot ignore this root cause, and we have to address the elephant in the room. If we talk about it's tribal nations versus people claiming tribal identity, the white people that are enabling this, the non-natives that are enabling this, the power structures, the paradigms that enable this.
Barnes says that in the worst of cases, states and other organizations in the Ohio River Valley have recognized and worked with the people and groups appropriating tribal identity as being legitimately Shawnee, and have provided them with human remains that need to be reburied under NAGPRA regulations. That's the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act.
So what I would propose is we start questioning this paradigm, questioning this modern form of existential threat against tribal nations, of raping us of our identities. I don't think that's too small of a term. I really don't. If you've seen the minstrel shows that I have, if you've seen them steal the remains of your ancestors and bury them in a parking lot in Sandusky, Ohio, because the coroner contacted the wrong group and contacted some fakes, then in the spring thaw, those bones were exposed again. This is serious business. This is a serious problem. And I think we need to define the problem. And I think we need to talk about terms. What are the terms? What are the definitions that we need to work with? What is sovereignty? How does sovereignty become meaningless from this activity? And what damage do individual clout seekers cause to tribal nations and our communities, stealing the essence of who we are as a people so that they can chase their own personal clout? I would also challenge the ecosystems in which this thrives, federal and state governments, within academia, within the arts community, and elsewhere. We have generations of race-shifting people. They want a certain cachet, a certain exoticism or whatever. And they want to add to their brand, and they're using the backs of indigenous peoples to do it. And I'm done with it. I cannot help promote my culture. I cannot help grow my language. I cannot see us flourish as a people when as soon as we start to grow, as soon as we start to thrive, these people come along and they clip the hedges and they take from us and it forces us to, you know, draw back again. I won't have it. Not in my watch.
Delcy Wilson from the Serpent Mound says her organization's no tribal policing policy makes sure that everyone at their events is included. But Barnes says that attitude has real consequences for American Indian people.
Whenever we see across the United States this tendency towards embracing inclusion at the expense of truth, when we embrace diversity at the expense of Native tribal nations, at the expense of, you know, pillaging our culture so that other folks can feel special, we have to challenge that. So there's no one out there that's left behind Shawnee. We're not kicking you out because of quantum. We're not gatekeeping. You're just simply not a citizen. And some of these things, you know, result in failed NAGPRA consults where these groups come in and they want to be at the table. They don't get to sit at the table. This problem also causes more problems and exacerbates existing issues like missing and murdering indigenous women when the minstrel shows use images of hypersexualization via stereotypes and racist imagery. These are difficult conversations. The time is well past and we have them in the open. It's not our job to make non-natives comfortable. It's our job to nourish our cultures, nourish our people, ensure our children and grandchildren speak our language, ensure that our people have the rights to practice their indigenous religion that goes back millennia. It's not to be assumed. We are not a product. Thank you, and I appreciate it.
You're listening to The Ohio Country from public radio station 91.3 WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Stay with us.
As you heard, the Ohio History Connection has made an effort in the past 20 years to work with federally recognized tribes to address some of the issues that Chief Barnes raised, and to ensure that the activities at sites they own and oversee, including Serpent Mound, accurately reflect American Indian people of the past and present.
Bujo, Alex Wison, Desnakosh, Pokaganik, Potawatomi, and Dow, Mishike, and Dodem, Columbus, Ohio, and Dochbia. So what I just said is Alex Wison is what I'm called. I'm a part of the Pokagan Band of Potawatomi Indians. I'm a part of the Turtle Clan, and I live in Columbus, Ohio. So that's a traditional opening and greeting in Potawatomi or Potawatomi.
Alex Wison is the former director of American Indian Affairs for the Ohio History Connection. Wison is now the director and relationship manager for Native American Financial Services at Huntington Bank. Wison is an enrolled citizen of the Pokagan Band of Potawatomi, which is based in Michigan today, but whose people historically lived in what we now call Ohio. He's an elected official in his tribe, serving as the treasurer. He's also a social scientist with a doctorate from Ohio State. When Chris interviewed him in 2023, he was still with the Ohio History Connection, and Chris asked him to discuss how the OHC works with tribes.
I think we're going through something really special with tribal engagement right now in this state. So, you know, the state isn't obligated in any way to work with tribes. Well, let me take that back. The state is obligated in very limited ways in which they're required from a federal perspective to engage with tribes. At the Ohio History Connection, we go above and beyond to work with the tribes and actually bring them into the stories that we're telling and sharing in ways that enrich the history that's told. I think far too often history is seen, at least I remember as a young person, it would always seem like history would be just kind of a linear sort of path about, well, this happened, then this happened, then this happened. But what that really misses is the diversity of perspectives on history and the way things happened. And of course, history is something that we all share. And that's why there can be so many different perspectives on it. The way that we're challenging ourselves, the way that our board has approved an American Indian policy in 2019 that really challenges our organization to think about what are ways that we have tribal stories and perspectives at our 59 sites across the state? And the perspective is so much richer because there's language that gets brought into it, like we've talked about a couple of times. There's very different perspectives on the traditional history that's told. And I think that has not only set us apart nationally from our peers, the other historical societies across the country, but we're even starting to get recognition internationally for the work that we're doing. I think it speaks to that, the appetite for folks to learn more about tribes.
Wison understands the nuances of the federal recognition process and tribal sovereignty well. His dissertation is about modern American Indian nations and how tribes, including his own, the Pokagan Band, interact with state and federal governments in the United States.
There are ebbs and flows of federal Indian policy. There are times when they're very friendly to tribes, and there are times when they've not been so friendly. So in the 30s, as we're in the, I think we would have been in the Depression then or around there, there were not as many federal resources to go around. And at that time, tribes were seen as taking resources from the federal government. So at that time, tribes were being terminated so that they would take less federal resources, unfortunately. So we were administratively terminated. Just because the federal government at that point in time said, you're not a tribe anymore, that wasn't the case. We were still a tribe. We always were a tribe, always will be a tribe. And we fought and petitioned the federal government for decades to be fairly reaffirmed of our sovereignty. It took an act of Congress, and President Clinton at the time in 1994 signed the Pokagan Reaffirmation Act.
And what did that recognition do? What did it allow the tribe to grow into?
Yeah, so it opens up resources for the tribe from the federal government. They're pretty modest when you look comparatively at things. But what it's enabled us to do is it's a recognition by the federal government that the tribe is a sovereign status. So there are different viewpoints about what tribal sovereignty means. What I equate tribes to today when you think about tribal sovereignty is I think they're basically the equivalent of a state now in a lot of ways, with a lot of federal handholding for what we have to reach out to them for approval on things. But because we have that sovereignty, we were able to do our gaming enterprises to develop gaming and bring in those resources that we can then provide all kinds of benefits to our citizenry now. That is just really, it's really incredible what the previous leaders of the tribe have been able to put in place.
In his role as American Indian Director for the Ohio History Connection, Wiesaw says he was regularly asked by members of the public in Ohio about who can and should consider themselves Native American.
There seems to be this fascination with like a blood quantum, like saying you're a certain proportion Native American. That's not a tribal way of doing things or establishing. I mean, it is a way for some tribes of establishing their citizenry, but it's a legacy of colonialism and it's a legacy of federal Indian policies that sought to extinguish tribes. I mean, it's incredibly sad. So, but our tribe, the way that we establish our citizenry is through lineal descent. So in order for me to be a citizen of the tribe, one of my parents has to be a citizen of the tribe.
Wiesaw also encountered groups of people who claim to be remnant bands of Shawnee or other tribes left behind in Ohio after removals, including groups that have formed nonprofits.
I don't know that I would have much to say about it. What I would say is there is a process for federal recognition, and if these groups really truly believe that they're tribal, they should be working with the executive branch in the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the federal government to receive their federal recognition. And if they were able to do that, if they were able to prove those things, then they would be tribal and they would be federally recognized. I think it's telling that they don't have that status and that I'm not aware of them seeking that. Maybe they are, and I'm just not aware of it. But just because I think it is misleading for someone to claim that their state recognized in Ohio when the Ohio Revised Code doesn't have that in it, number one. And number two, just because you receive a proclamation from the governor that recognizes, I'm not saying this governor, but just because I've heard this sort of, well, we've got this proclamation from the governor recognizing us. Just because you have that, I don't know that it's real recognition. Or the last thing I've heard is that, well, we can claim that we're state recognized because we have a 501c3 status by the Secretary of State in Ohio. And I'm like, that's not state recognition. That's recognition of the state of a 501c3 nonprofit. That's not being a state recognized tribe. So
that's Alex Wiesaw. He'll be back in a few minutes. But now, let's visit a place where you are likely to meet people who claim to be part of unrecognized remnant bands of Shawnee.
The Clark County Park District owns George Rogers Clark Park near Springfield, Ohio. So the Ohio History Connection doesn't have a say about how American Indian people are represented there. If you remember from episode 3, this park is named after the American military leader George Rogers Clark, who destroyed the Shawnee village that once stood here during a Revolutionary War battle. The Fair at New Boston is a historical reenactment fair at George Rogers Clark Park that occurs annually over Labor Day weekend. They advertise that at the fair you can meet the, quote, heroes and pioneers of early Ohio from 1780 to 1810, end quote. The fair is part living history, part Renaissance fair, with many vendors, performances, and people dressed up in costumes. The mood is a certain kind of patriotic. Think no taxation without representation. Veterans are given a discount at the gate, and some of the interpreters reenact a battle from the 1794 Whiskey Rebellion, in which vigilantes attacked U.S. Marshals because they didn't want to pay a liquor tax. You can also visit what the fair calls a Native American village. On the Friday before the long weekend begins, it's a school day, and thousands of students from around the county visit the fair. One vendor sells bird whistles, and the kids love them. The kids are also impressed by the Native American village, where a dozen or so interpreters are dressed in animal skins and working on arts and crafts, telling stories while tending to a fire, or chucking tomahawks at trees. Some of them are wearing red face. Others have darkened their skin with dirt. The village was designed to replicate what an 18th century Shawnee village would have looked like. But according to Shawnee historians, it's largely inaccurate. I meet a man in the village. He has painted his face red, is holding a war club while wearing dead animal skins and moccasins, and he is telling kids stories around a fire in a building that is supposed to look like a wigwam.
Russell Morris is my name. We're just here trying to get some history out to these kids today that probably don't hear a lot of it anymore. Yeah, trying to teach them about the natives.
How many kids did you talk to today?
Oh, boy. I don't think I can count that high. I flunked out on arithmetic. I'd say an easy couple hundred, easy. There's been quite a few kids coming through here. And I've been making sure they're all asking questions, too.
Morris says he's Shawnee and is being paid to tell stories at the fair this weekend, but he's not a member of a federally recognized tribe.
We got our own thoughts about the federally recognized thing and not, you know, and I don't know. My idea is God made two people, both of them Shawnee. One says he's better because he has a card from the government that says you're allowed to be a native, where the other one don't have a card from the government. But they're both native. But the guy with the card says you're not because the government don't accept you. But the only reason that they're card carriers is because, I mean, if you want to cut the hide off everything and peel it back, they went out and signed with the enemy, which was the government. Of course, they're going to be recognized. The ones who didn't aren't going to be recognized. That's the only difference. But they want to take it to a whole nother level.
So growing up, did you know that you were Shawnee? Was it in your family?
Yes. But we were told not to say nothing. Because I believe, I'm not real sure about the year, but I think up until 1968, the government, if they knew you were a native, they could come in and take your property and move you out to a reservation. So my dad always told me, hey, don't be going around telling everybody you're native now. But, you know, little blonde-haired, blue-eyed kid, I didn't have much to worry about, you know. Nobody was asking me that.
What Morris just said about the government seeking out Native American people, taking their land, and forcing them to move onto reservations in Oklahoma into the 1960s is false. There aren't any historical records of it happening. And as we learned about in Episode 8, the forced relocation of American Indian people from the Ohio River Valley in the 1830s and 1840s was conducted by the U.S. government on a community scale. I asked Morris for more details about his ancestry. He says one of his forebears was married to a Shawnee woman. So you trace your Shawnee heritage on your dad's side?
Yes.
And do you kind of know the details of how they were able to, I guess, you know, evade, you know, the government for so many years? And
well, what I was told was my one of them great grandfathers or somebody was a Scottish trader up on the Kanawha River. And his son moved down to Madison, Indiana, before it was a town. And that's where they met the grandmother. Where then the Trail of Tears come rolling around, where they wanted them all to move. And I guess the townspeople said, no, she's not a native. She was born here with us. So she got to stay. She didn't have to get forced out. So that's kind of the highlights of our story.
Do you, I guess through doing this work, have you met a lot of other people that have a similar story to you?
Yeah, quite a few. Yeah, there's some really nice people reenacting. I mean, I tell my friends that, well, you get out here and get in this community and these people are just super nice people.
Earlier in this episode, Chief Ben Barnes of the Shawnee tribe talked about the first time he saw people representing themselves as Shawnee in Ohio at the 2014 bicentennial celebration of the Second Treaty of Greenville. Russell Morris was one of those people at the event. He says Barnes snubbed him after he, Morris, performed a Shawnee ceremony.
Morris pointed out another person in the village, who he said is his mentor and one of the premier Shawnee storytellers in the region. So I went and talked to him. His name is Randy Bales. I asked him what kind of stories he likes to tell.
I tell one about the squirrel getting the tail. Sorry, the squirrel getting the tail from the chipmunk. And actually, that popped into my head Thursday morning when I was on my way to work.
Bales has been coming to places like the Fair at New Boston and getting paid to represent Shawnee people for more than 40 years.
You know, I was reading about Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone, and I watched the old TV shows and all that stuff and everything. And then when I got involved with people who said, yeah, we do this stuff, and we go out and shoot the guns and throw tomahawks and everything, I was like, oh, neat.
Bales is covered in tattoos. He says they are Shawnee tattoos and tries to speak a bit of Shawnee when explaining them.
I tell people, this is the sign of where I was born. This was the river, the Spelewithipi, which is the Ohio River. And these are the tattoos of the campfires of our people that were along the river. And this is almost the same kind of a thing. They're actually, I was told, it's actually otter tracks. And because an otter leaves his tracks, but his tail drags in the sand. And they said, this is geometric otter tracks. But it was just a sign of an otter. Ironically, when I got the tattoos, I thought it was just a cool symbol, both of them. And after the guy told me that, I actually had a Native American zodiac thing. And when I pull up my birthday, it says I'm one of the otter people. So it's really, you know, a friend of mine used to say, there's no coincidence. There's always something will happen for a reason.
Bales repeated the same falsehood as Morris about coming from a family who had to keep their Shawnee identity secret because of the government. But Bales says he has also done DNA tests that confirm the tribal identity he claims.
Because if you said you were an Indian, there was actually laws on the books fairly recently that if you were an Indian and somebody liked your property, they could make you move to Oklahoma and they could take your property. So I always wondered. I always had the interest in everything, and everybody's like, no. So I actually did the DNA thing, and then it showed up big time. You know, it's like, yeah, there it is.
When asked if he had found any genealogical evidence that he has Shawnee ancestors, he said his cousin on his mom's side found someone who had married what he called a native woman.
And ironically, their descendants all liked each other. So I'm related to myself three or four times. My grandmother's last name was Newland, N-E-W-L-A-N-D, and my grandfather's mother was a Newland, so they were distant cousins. So I said, if you go down the line, I'm related to myself three or four times, so.
Both Bales and Morris knew about the Ohio History Connection's American Indian policy, and they aren't happy about it excluding them from doing historical reenactment at those sites. They both used to go to the OHC's Fort Ancient Hopewell Ceremonial Earthworks for an annual Native American festival. Here's Morris.
So let's just stop this thing. And that's what they did. They all just jumped on it and just close it down and we'll discuss it later. Well, once it's closed, there's no more discussion, you know. And they basically shut that thing down. I mean, that brought in thousands and thousands of dollars to that area. But they had everybody running scared. That's what it was.
As of 2024, the George Rogers Clark Heritage Association, which runs the fair at New Boston, hasn't been willing to implement a policy requiring its Native American interpreters to be citizens of federally recognized tribes. Phil Campbell is the vice president of the Heritage Association. He doesn't believe that tribal citizens are uniquely qualified to be historic interpreters.
I think that people that know the history should be the ones teaching the history. I don't think genetics has anything to do with your knowledge base. But just because you have a card doesn't mean that I think you have a step up on the history, unless you've done the work. Or you have family history that have come down from, you know, through the family. That's great, too.
Leanne Castillo is the executive director of the National Trail Parks and Recreation District. Her organization oversees George Rogers Clark Park and lets the George Rogers Clark Heritage Association rent the park for the fair at New Boston every year. She says her organization doesn't plan to implement a policy requiring Native American interpreters in its parks to be citizens of federally recognized tribes. Castillo says the district has been too busy dealing with a park district merger. Jeremy Turner is a professional historic interpreter and a citizen of the Shawnee tribe who we heard from in an earlier episode. Turner's on the board of an American Indian-led organization based in Southwest Ohio called Caesars Ford Theater. Caesars Ford is working with small local parks and historic reenactment organizations in the region to help connect them with citizens of federally recognized tribes who can do these historic interpretations. Caesars Ford did try to work with both the George Rogers Clark Heritage Association and the National Trail Parks and Recreation District, but was unable to convince them to change their policy. Turner says it isn't his organization's intention to restrict what people like Morris and Bales do or believe in a private setting. Here he is talking about that during a webinar.
It's one thing if, you know, a group of friends want to go out and go out into the woods and dress up as Indians for the weekend and go and camp out and all of that. That's one thing. If they want to do that, that's fine. It's a private deal. They're going out by themselves. But when it comes to any public event, especially, you know, a lot of these events incorporate a Friday school day where they are bringing in thousands of school kids, mostly elementary age school kids, under the auspices that they are teaching them accurate history about American Indian people. When you bring that into it, it throws right out the window the ability, in my mind, for non-American Indian people to be interpreting themselves as American Indians. In any living history site, any museum, any place that thinks that's okay to do is wrong, and is wrong. And that's why we are going to continue to up the bar at Caesars Ford Theater and make sure that we are giving tribal citizens the opportunities to do those programs, you know, to reconnect with their homelands, to go out to their historic homelands and be involved and connected, reconnected with those places that their families were forcibly removed from against their will.
Turner also points out that the Shawnee tribe and the Delaware Nation have passed resolutions opposing, quote, red face, end quote, and non-tribal citizens representing themselves as Delaware and Shawnee to the public. Caesars Ford says both of these resolutions were shared with the George Rogers Clark Heritage Association and the National Trail Parks and Recreation District. Alex Wiesaw from the OHC says that many of the Ohioans he has encountered who claim to have a tribal identity or who are non-native but like to represent themselves as Native American at historical events think their actions are honoring modern American Indian culture or that they are doing tribes a favor. But Wiesaw says that's often not the case, especially when they spread false information or wear inaccurate costumes. But he says there are ways for Ohioans who aren't citizens of federally recognized tribes to form genuine connections with tribal communities today.
True allyship is approaching topics with humility and being open to understanding history from a different perspective. I think far too often there are stories that people learn that I learned growing up here that I now know are inaccurate. But when you think about the contextual factors of what of maybe how those stories changed over time is because there were not Native people here to maybe share those stories. So I encounter folks all the time that say, oh, well, you know, I've got this great, 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 great grandma who was a Cherokee princess. And it's like, I appreciate what you're saying, because I think what at their core, they're trying to make a connection, like with me, for example, or with other Native people. When I try to help them understand that the Cherokees were not a monarchy, they didn't have royalty like that in the way that I think they're thinking. So there's a re-education that has to happen. And I think that's where the humility comes in and the open-mindedness needs to happen is you might think you know the answer to something, but if you're fortunate to work with someone who's tribal and they're sharing knowledge with you, Just be open to hearing what they're sharing and don't just jump to say, well, no, I don't think that's right. I guess at the end of the day, I'd say that's what I think allyship is being open-minded and humble to learning something new that you might not always think of. But then I think once you have that knowledge, it can then be your responsibility to share that with someone or spark someone else's interest, because I hope that there's folks that take interest in tribes, because there's really incredible things that are happening with tribes that are larger, small communities that are really compassionate and really caring and want to share their histories and their customs and perspectives with people a lot. But I think that there's sometimes an assumption that tribes are just sitting and waiting to share their histories or share what they have or what they know with people. And that's just not always the case. So again, that's where that humility comes in, is just being persistent and asking for advice from tribes or visiting tribes if you're so inclined to do so, or if we're ever able to meet with folks, if I'm able to meet with folks, just kind of be patient, because there's a lot of knowledge gap out there that it's exhausting for those of us that are Native to have to try to catch everyone else up on almost 250 years of history that might not have always been told the most accurately.
That was Alex Wiesaw speaking for the Ohio History Connection in his role as Director of American Indian Affairs in 2023. He is now the Director and Relationship Manager for Native American Financial Services at Huntington Bank in Columbus.
Next week on The Ohio Country, in the final episode of this season, we'll go to the grand opening of Great Council State Park and meet again with Chief Glenna Wallace.
The story is not a pleasant story. But all of us alive today, we weren't responsible for that. So why put the guilt on people? I don't intend to do that. I just say I come willing to speak to you, but I will always try to have a message of hope. I will always try to have history in there. I will always try to have humor in there so that you can go away and make the decision for yourself. Do I really know the history of Ohio?
That's in the next episode of The Ohio Country from public radio station WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Thanks for listening.
This was episode 11 of The Ohio Country. It was written and reported by Chris Welter, the managing editor at the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices at WYSO. The editor of The Ohio Country is Samantha Summer. Dr. John Bickers is the cultural advisor. He's an assistant professor at Case Western University and a citizen of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma. Layla Troyer designed our logo. She's a citizen of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma. Flawn Williams is the audio mixer, and the composer is Evan Miller. I'm the digital producer, Mary Evans. To find photographs, maps, and links, go to wyso.org/podcast. This program is made possible through a partnership with Ohio Humanities, a nonprofit that shares stories to spark conversations and ideas, and by the National Endowment for the Humanities, a More Perfect Union initiative. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of Ohio Humanities or the National Endowment for the Humanities.
To see visual content related to The Ohio Country, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. And for a full transcript of every episode made by humans, go to wyso.org.
Hello again. Now that you've heard this episode, let me explain again. This 12-part series was made at a small public radio station in Southwest Ohio called WYSO. We had financial support from Ohio Humanities, but we relied on WYSO staff and infrastructure to get the job done. So we'd be grateful if you could make a contribution at wyso.org.